Professor Carlos Lopez. He's an honorary professor at the Mandela School and is currently the AU High Representative to support member states in the negotiation of a new agreement with the European Union post 2020, and the member of the organizing team, a reform team that was under the presidency of Paul Kagame. Professor Lopez has not only written on economic and development issues when he was also serving as executive director of the Economic Commission for Africa, but he's also actively written on climate issues on the continent and has a very unique take on it, and you will hear more of that as we go along.
I'm going to bring you some insights, if I may, about the connection between the economic impact of COVID in Africa, which is going to be quite devastating, and the opportunities that it offers for changing our development patterns, and therefore, you know, being able to use it as an opportunity for climate action. First, I want to mention that the China-US trade war that has introduced turbulence in the world markets was followed by the Saudi Arabia-Russia oil prices war, have actually foreshown that the 2011 end of the commodity super cycle could get actually much worse than it was predicted. With historical lows for Brent prices in the US, plunging sometimes below zero in the recent weeks, and it's the first time that it happens in history, there is little doubt left, I think, about the volatility of a commodity, oil, that represents nevertheless 40% of total African exports, which is quite astounding. Since 2007, the volume of Africa's crude petroleum exports to the world has started to decrease. So it's not on the increase, it's on the decrease. China, that imports quite a big chunk of it, is shrinking its imports dramatically, following previous decreases that came from the US, because now they have their own production and others. So the bottom line is this: we have 7.5% of oil reserves worldwide, and about 7.1% of gas reserves worldwide, which basically means that Africa is not really a big player in this market in global terms, a player capable of determining prices or occupy a premium place in the market. Therefore, we suffer the consequences of whatever behavior exists in the market. And we know that the levels of volatility have increased, but also the demand is going down. So what COVID-19 has done is basically to driven home this message. The prices of renewable energy production, as we know, are becoming not only more competitive by the day, but they have surpassed in most cases the costs of producing energy through fossil fuels matrices. So this makes this particular crisis the right time to shift towards a cleaner, low carbon production consumption base, way beyond energy, but based specifically on energy as the entry point. So in other words, Africa, in fact, has the luxury of being able to accelerate its industrialization, because we need to do that. I'm a defender of it, but with greener solutions, both in terms of energy, because you are a latecomer, you don't have to retrofit, you just jump into the latest available technological solutions, and in this case, cleaner and proper solutions, and also extended to sustainable infrastructure. You don't need to build the new infrastructure with the characteristics of the past. You can make it sustainable. So extremely low prices for oil, but also for coal, associated with this depressed demand in the countries that normally we export, translate into a unique chance to get rid of heavily subsidized fossil fuel consumption in our own countries, which is a big problem in many African countries, and also the option of dismantling what I call the Byzantine tax system that has plugged into the price of fuel in the pump, that is so dependent on you know, the government's trying to raise taxes in a very lazy way through consumption of oil-related products. So I think these characteristics have created awareness and policy imperative for us to move forward in a completely different pattern. Second, although not as dramatic as the fall in oil and gas prices, the other commodities composing African exports, because we export mostly raw, being metals, extractives, or even agricultural related soft commodities or fisheries, they have all been exposed to high levels of volatility. They have all been also marked by this crisis in terms of, you know, how vulnerable those exports are. If you have, like Africa does, 35 countries out of 54 in the highly commodity dependent export category, which is classified by UNCTAD as countries that have at least high 80% or higher dependency on commodity exports, you can imagine that a crisis like this one basically shows that we are at the tail end of any possible recovery, because, you know, demand is going to be highly affected by the characteristics of the pandemic, but also because of the volatility of this type of markets. This basically is a colonial characteristic responsible for some of the rent-seeking behavior, lazy domestic taxation efforts. We have only 15% average fiscal pressure when the world average is 35%, precisely because rent seekers don't need to make any efforts. On the contrary, they are very lazy on taxation efforts because that's the way they produce corruption, allow capital flight, and basically don't need to take care of the public sector the way they should. So COVID-19 has demonstrated this fragility of the African growth trajectory. So it was pretty good in January, with 16 out of the 30 best performing countries in the IMF projections being Africa, with about half of the continent's population living in about 21 countries, but 650 million people in countries projected to have growth of 5% or more. And yet, you know, all of this just disappeared overnight with the COVID-19, and it's going to be very difficult to reshape, because we are not going to have any V performance curve. We are going to have a very long U because of the characteristics of precisely this type of vulnerabilities. So the powerful message to the African leaders is that they need to adjust to a new normal. And insofar as Africa is concerned, the new normal has to be also changing development pattern. One good example of that is food security. The situation is there because we have floods in Eastern Africa. We have a very long drought in many parts of Southern Africa. We have locust invasion in the Horn of Africa, and we have a very bad rainy season in the Sahel, exacerbating conflicts that are linked to environmental stress. So what is the message? The message is that all of these crises are climate related. The food security dimension of the current crisis just reminds us that climate is part of this mix, and we need to seize the problem in its entirety, and only a sustainable and more productive agriculture will be able to tackle current chronic deficits. But this is not possible if we don't put climate action at the center of what we do. If we want to discuss livelihoods, it will translate into less emissions if Africans are capable of having a more productive agriculture, because right now the use of biomass is responsible for huge deforestation and also significant emissions. So it is in our interest to produce that type of transformation. And productivity in agriculture never happens without a link to industrialization. And that's why we have to do agro processing in a way that is sustainable. Here comes again the energy dimension and others that will allow us to think big. And if we want to add to the mix another element that is very much under discussion right now, which is the African Continental Free Trade Area, the largest such free trade area in the world by number of countries and population covered. This is an endeavor that will allow us to use smart protectionism to boost our intra-Africa value-added tradable products, which other free trade areas do, and there is no reason we shouldn't. So there is an opportunity to transform, starting with immediate need to deal with alternative food supplies. You know, COVID-19 has shown us the disruption of the existing value and supply chain, so time to wake up. Again, such a redrafting of the geography of the value chains will be good for the environment for a number of counts. For instance, what is the point if we want to really deal with climate consequences to be exporting raw materials across the globe to Asia, to be transformed there, to be transported again across the world to the consumption markets in Europe and the US, when Africa can be part of that supply and value chain geography. But energy access, nevertheless, is going to be the essential point. And to have buy-in, even from policymakers in Africa and public at large, and also from an economic sense point of view, we need to really zero in on energy as the key ingredient for this transformation. Growth of this sector promises not only to plug the gap with regard to electricity generation, particularly in light of, you know, our growing demands, growing population, our demography, but also to help the continent achieve its climate goals if we do it properly. We know that the opportunities are there, but the challenges are also there. We have security challenges, socio-political challenges, but we have also a risk perception that is not fabricated. It exists. It includes, you know, weak or even, one can say, underdeveloped regulatory environment. We keep shifting energy policies all the time. The issue of credit worthiness of state-owned utility companies that is coming on the way of, you know, real reform. Corruption, political pressure, lack of money, lack of financing for projects, of course, and also contestation over land, which is also now becoming quite present in the debate. And I think all of this can be addressed up front as part of a large endeavor of structural transformation, and COVID is just pushing us in that direction. And finally, I just want to highlight the need for policies to include full cost accounting of natural capital and ecological infrastructure in terms of how they support biodiversity, how they support ecosystems, how they support climate change mitigation and adaptation, and so on. So if we go for investments in nature-based solutions, which I believe should become the underpinning objective of all our future policies, then we should aim at restoring areas of natural habitat to enable biodiversity responses, improved ecosystems, and continued provision of services that is going in such direction. And I believe, because of our demography, we are helped by the youthness of the continent, because youth are agents of change. I always say that innovation only makes economic sense if you transform it into something that can be consumed one way or another. And technological innovation follows the same pattern. And what we are witnessing on the part of youth worldwide is an attitude to be much more cautious about consumption patterns, much more aware of the damage to the climate, to damage to nature, and wanting solutions that are different. And where is the big reservoir of youthness in the world? I think we all know the answer. Thank you.
Thank you, Carlos. And just to say that was a wonderful opening remarks and setting a great framework in terms of just understanding the dependencies and the fragilities of the African continent in terms of its dependency on commodities as a main form of earnings and exchange. But also, I think you've highlighted the importance of interregional trade to diversify the economy. Energy access is going to be crucial. And I think what you highlighted fundamentally is that we could rethink and reimagine how we move forward in order to make more robust and sustainable economies in the future in a much broader sense.
From the questions you framed, I think the issue of climate financing is obviously a very important one. And what I would like to say is that we have now a complete disruption in the way global economic governance was conceived, thanks to COVID-19. Some of the trends were already there, but you know they have been exacerbated by COVID-19 crisis. You have language coming from, let's say, the Bretton Woods institutions, but more largely from international financial institutions that is completely different from the tradition. There is a call for countries to forget about deficits. There is a fear of stagflation and deflation rather than inflation. And you know, stimulus packages amount to basically, at the end of the day, printing money and distributing the consequences of that into the economy. Now, what obviously African countries face is a very different situation. They are not able to print money or to stimulate their economy that way, because obviously they will be badly rated by the rating agencies, and the risks associated with such policy will be considered absolutely insurmountable. So they have to adjust to be sort of in the begging bowl attitude of trying to see whether others can contribute to their stimulus packages as a way of not compromising their market stance and how they are perceived in the market. And I think this is coming to a head. It's not possible to maintain that type of contradiction where you treat public debt in a certain way in parts of the world and you treat it completely different in Africa. Because at the end of the day, what is offered as a compensation for Africa's vulnerabilities is that we can have access to concessional funding. Well, that is a myth, because although the amounts for concessional lending in international financial institutions for Africa has increased to historical levels over the last few years, the reality is that the economies of the continent have doubled in size, and as a result, even that increase does not correspond to the same levels of concessional funding that were available in the 90s. And nobody's talking about it. So countries are basically to finance their economies, and because they don't do their domestic work of, you know, having better taxation systems, as I've mentioned. And it's always important to open a parenthesis when I mention taxes, because it's not about taxing the poor. It's about taxing the rich. It's about taxing the informality of the rich, not the informality of the poor. and all these concessions that are made, and the laziness of the tax system, because it allows corruption to take advantage. But you know, that parenthesis is being dealt with. At the end of the day, we don't have enough credit into the economy. Therefore, the public debts in Africa are obliged to go to commercial market. And when they do, and they issue euro bonds and the like, they get 6-7% interest rates. Now, compare this with the UK, that has just last week issued the same sovereign debt offerings and get negative yields. So, I mean, it's like the best of the concessional. People pay you to lend you money. So you can see the inequality discourse that we have in so many fronts applies also to public debt. So if you treat the public debt of the poorest with 6-7% and you treat the public debt of the richest with negative yields, there is a huge gap that is only going to exacerbate the possibilities of access to finance and the inequality of the consequences of contracting public debt. And this is also the reason why we need to move into a different framework. And it is the different framework, financial framework, that is now possible to discuss, that was not possible to discuss before, because public debt has become a worldwide problem. It's no longer an African problem. And if it is a worldwide problem, then it is the opportunity for us to insert in the discussion a different type of conditionality list, a different type of sustainability of debt framework, and therefore introduce the climate-related impacts of different types of lending into the equation. And this was not possible before, but now is absolutely essential discussion to have. And climate finance has probably ahead of it, very interesting times, because now the discussion has evolved and everybody's concerned about the impacts. And it is not a coincidence that some of the stimulus packages, it's obviously not the case in the US, but for most of the other countries, are associated with greening of the economy, new green deals, and so forth. So this is really an opening, and I think a brighter future for Africa to exercise a bit of agency in this discussion. Another point that you mentioned was the issue of recovery. Of course, our recovery, first, I think it's important for us to bear in mind that our recovery is going to be much more longer than other regions of the world. Not because of the sanitary dimensions of the crisis, because everybody tells the peak in Africa has not yet been attained. Therefore, we are going to have the consequences in a much longer sort of time frame than the rest of the world, because we are still looking for our peak. Be as it may, I think regardless of the sanitary dimensions, the characteristics that are going to induce our crisis, economic crisis, are different from the rest of the world, because the commodity prices are going to probably start recovering as soon as the world markets become a bit more regularized. We see already trends on oil and others. But what people forget is that in most of the commodities, hard commodities, we are dealing with future markets. So people are buying now what they will consume in April, in May, and so forth. And right now we know the stocks on fossil fuels, which is 40% of our exports, are at the all-time high. That's why, the Brent in the US was paid, for people even to keep the oil because of stocks, not having where to stock, which means that buying oil in the future markets is going to be something that is going to materialize in terms of higher prices by the middle of next year. So this is a very long period of recovery. When it comes to soft commodities, it's even worse, because a lot of them depends on good logistics. Like, for instance, if you export cocoa, you export tea, you export cashew nuts, you export coffee, you need or fresh cut flowers, you need good logistics. Africa already suffered for a limitation of logistics, but what we exported was what was possible with the logistics available, but now we have even less than the usual logistics available, which means that a lot of these products are going to be deteriorating because they are perishable. And this is going to create a huge problem with exporters of soft commodities. Then you have the problem of tourism. Although tourism is not as important sector in some countries, it's still, even in countries where it's not as important contributor to GDP, one of the largest employers. Because tourism is labor intensive. So we can estimate that about 10% of all formal employment in Africa is linked to tourism one way or another. And this is going to have a very long recovery period because first people have to get trust into traveling, air travel in particular. But even when they do, they will go to closer locations, and Africa is a bit distant from its originating markets of tourists. So we are going to be at the tail end of the recovery of the tourist sector. And finally, we have the remittances from migrants that are more important than ODA, that attained more than 60 billion last year, whereas ODA is below 50. And yet, we know from different projections that our diaspora is going to suffer in their countries of location. And they are not going to be able to contribute as much as they do to their families. And as a result, we expect between 20 and 30% decrease this year. Add to this the problems that we are having with debt, because depreciating our currencies that has been on a downward trend since the beginning of this crisis. The fact that we have huge capital flight. It is estimated that we already lost about 18 billion since the beginning of the crisis on capital flight. Add to the fact that we have a bigger amount of debt servicing to pay on local currency because our debt is mostly denominated in hard currency. So all these factors make our recovery very long. And therefore, the socioeconomic impact and the jobs impact is going to be huge and much more lasting than other parts of the world. And this is much more problematic than the sanitary dimension itself. And that's why countries really have to think through the consequences of whatever measures they take to tackle the sanitary, because they are going to have to reckon with this incredible long period of recovery. There was another question about trade and the regional dimensions. Yes, I think what we have seen emerging from the discussions provoked by COVID-19 crisis was, for instance, whether the CFTA, the Continental Free Trade Agreement, should be postponed or should be moving fast forward. I think that is a discussion that is more political than technical. Obviously, the political momentum has to be sustained, but the technical dimensions of putting together a continental free trade area cannot really proceed during a crisis like this one. And we should not confuse the two. We will do the best in terms of the political front, but it's obviously not going to be possible to keep the same calendar and sequencing that was anticipated before this crisis. And I think what is important is actually to use this crisis to demonstrate the need for us to exercise much stronger agency in our dealings with our partners. I'll give you the example that I'm in charge of, which is relations with Europe. What we have seen is that a lot of European countries have immediately suspended the exports of protective equipment, the export of some pharmaceutical products and reagents for the testing. This is what we have seen. And it's a wake-up call that we need to have our own autonomy, and we have to have our regional value chains that replace in strategic areas imports that can be suspended you know, from you know, whatever crisis arises, solidarity disappears overnight. And that's what Tasnim was mentioning. This crisis has taught us the need for solidarity, and some are not exercising it. Thank you. I'm just going to focus on two issues, the relations with Europe and the relations with China, because they are illustrative of the need for that agency that Tasnim is calling for and that I have also emphasized. On Europe, they are discussing their Green Deal. And obviously, we should be excited that Europe wants to be a leader on green fronting of economic policies. But we have to be careful for this not to be transformed into yet another avenue to maintain Africa on the sidelines. I'm not saying that is the main purpose of their policy design, but it can be the consequence, unless we react and become quite aware of the basically the threats and the opportunities offered by the shaping of the European Green Deal. Why am I saying this? Two illustrations very quickly. When they say they are going to have a border carbon tax, that can be indicative of how they are going to treat their trade. Obviously, they are not going to apply that 100% of everything they import. They will be selective. And in order to get, you know, sort of a pass in terms of whatever threshold is established, it's easier to get that pass with the African countries than get it with, let's say, China or the US. So we may have to adjust to, you know, passing the border tax of the Green European Deal by not changing the pattern of our exports. And this is something that is quite threatening if we want really to privilege our own transformation process. Another example is that they may say we are going to, because of the Green Deal, apply different support systems for our productive infrastructure, but that can be indirectly subsidies that are going to distort trade competitiveness and put the African countries in a situation where, in order to export to Europe, they will be obliged, and particularly processed goods, they will be obliged to have levels of certification that are very difficult to obtain, and yet, you know, their own producing centers will be able to benefit from subsidies that are not going to be called by that name, but they're basically subsidies that are going to distort trade regimes. So this is just some illustrations of how something that is noble, that we should support, European Green Deal, can have negative consequences for Africa if we are not attentive and if it is not part of our negotiations in such a way that, you know, we introduce as part of our partnership elements that are going to be good for Europe, but also good for Africa. And a bit the same story with China. China, as you have seen, is quite exposed because of COVID-19 having started in Wuhan, is quite exposed in terms of the narratives being developed around the responsibility of the country one way or another. And in order to counter that narrative, they have to be exercising high degrees of solidarity. And I think the cheapest that they can do in terms of, you know, investing in their reputational risk is actually to erase the African debt to the Chinese banks. Because we are talking about $145 billion. It's a very small cost for China, in relative terms, obviously. And it will be a huge solidarity movement in the direction of Africa. So we should encourage in the negotiations for this to happen. So far, what we have seen is that China has not been very keen and has not been the proponent for all reasons of the schemes being discussed about debt relief for the continent. And the reason is because China doesn't like to discuss that type of issues on a multilateral forum. They prefer to do it between themselves and African countries. So it is really up for the Africans to be able to get themselves organized to have such a discussion with China and not try to get to it through, you know, let's say international financial institutions deals, G20 and the rest. Thank you.